the following contains strong language and adult content. We tried to tell our hosts that they'll be talking about manga targeted at Japanese teenage boys, but they demanded access to what they call fuck words. So, here we are. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Shonen Fiasco Show, the number one book club for the self-loathing weeb. I am the host that manifests from your fears, Adam Tetramore.
Oh, wow. And I'm the host that manifests from your dreams, Alex
Hill. Oh, shit. I thought I was going to throw you for a loop on that one, but you came in hot with the response.
I had to think on my toes.
How are you doing, my friend?
I am hanging in there. I had a really funny moment last night that made my day, if you would like to hear.
I would love to hear for our nice cold open, our natural free flow cold open. Go right ahead.
So we have been watching Demon Slayer every Friday night in VR as well. So it's like we're all in a movie theater together.
Wait. I thought this was going to be a Demon Slayer themed cold open. It's now a, you watch movies in VR chat?
You can. Yeah, absolutely.
I did not know that.
Yeah, you can watch movies, anime. Like, there's things where, like, you can basically, like, if you have stuff on your computer or, like, have it in Dropbox, you can just, like, put, like, a link in there and it will, the video player will play it. Stuff like that.
Can you read manga?
That I don't know. I don't know.
That'd be really cool. It'd just be like, oh, let me just, because you know what? We work a lot with, like, digital media when it comes to manga.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really have that much in the way of like turning the page and actually having physical copies. So the idea of having all of these series that we talk about that never get put into the Western canon in a physical form, still being able to go into virtual reality and turn the pages and be like, oh, the page turn surprised me. Like,
you know,
that's actually a really cool idea.
That is a cool idea. Like, seriously, like, if there was, like, a manga library in VR chat, it's entirely possible that someone could make a world where they just have, like, I almost said the physical books, but they're, like, the books in VR, you could go up to a, you know, thing, grab it out, and just start flipping through and reading it. And honestly, if that was in VR chat, if that was an option, I'd probably read all of the stuff that we do in VR.
And then you would go into your VR realm podcast studio where you have all your accoutrement and you don't feel like you're trapped in a basement with pool noodles acting as your sound dampening equipment.
Piercing the veil there.
I completely interrupted your story, though.
You were okay.
In VR chat and you watched Demon Slayer.
Yeah. We're in VR chat and we're watching Demon Slayer. And we had just finished an ending of an arc that was really, really cool and really hype. And then because of the compression and maybe because we had too many people in the world or something, it started like messing up a little bit. So it kept like looping one part. And it's one part where one of the main characters is unleashing a pretty cool ability. And we started laughing because it sounded like she was saying buckets. So it's just like 10 minutes of her going, buckets, buckets,
buckets.
And so like buckets? the whole room, we're all just screaming buckets. We're all losing our mind at like 3 a.m. And it was the silliest. So
I'm trying to now think like what would be the worst moment in anime to just like have repeat, or what's the best moment? What comes to mind right away? Let's be honest here. It's got to be the Death Note. And eat it.
Just over and over.
He's just eating a bag of chips at that point. Like, he just, one by one, like, finishing the bag of chips. He's like, I'll eat this one. And then this one. I'll keep eating it.
I just think of every time Armstrong just loses his shirt and flexes. Just that one scene, just over and over, over and over.
You're trying to get everyone horny, maybe, I guess.
No, but the worst one, and you know that, like, if there's a scene that's gonna freeze when, like, your parents or like your roommates that don't know anything about anime or manga, you know, the mm-hmm. one scene it's gonna flip is the one where like someone's getting hurt and they're making some like very loud sound that sounds slightly sexual, and they're gonna come in and look at you and be like, the fuck are you watching?
And you just repeat that moment, the fuck are you watching? The fuck are you watching? The fuck are you watching? I'm very sorry. I have not had a moment like that. I don't watch embarrassing anime. I don't even read embarrassing manga. I just read every day the canceled manga of Shonen Jump, that's what we're here to focus on here on the Shonen Fiasco show. Any Shonen Jump series that didn't reach 50 chapters, that's what we're here for. And
that's right.
For this episode, ooh, I like this one.
Oh, I'm glad to hear you say that.
I'll spoil it for you. I like this one
a
lot.
Too.
When I started thinking about doing content for manga, for Shonen Jump in particular, this is one of the series that really made me want to do something. Like, before I was even thinking about doing a podcast, I was thinking about doing a random one-off YouTube diagnostic of this series, because there's so much to take apart and so much that makes it so unique from its predecessors that almost keeps it from being anything but a canceled manga, but is still greatly appreciated on my end, personally.
That makes me really happy to hear, because
good.
Also, spoiler alert, I enjoyed this one as well. But when yay. I was reading it, I was like, am I going to enjoy this and get into the podcast and Adam's going to be like, I hate this. You know, I was so nervous. Like, I was like, oh no.
I completely agree with you. I think for anyone that reads the series, it's going to be a love it or hate it. It's going to be this does something for you, or you're bored out of your mind. We here on this show probably fall into the former. Hopefully we can talk to you about why we fall into that category with a little bit of eloquency.
Yeah.
And with that said, we're going to go ahead and get to the pitch. Ryunosuke Fujita is an average third grade boy who wants nothing more but to play baseball and hang out with his friends. But after returning from the first day of school, he's suddenly introduced to a blind and wheelchair-bound girl by the name of Koharu Mori. Ryunosuke's father has taken the young girl into his home and informs the son that he will be homeschooled so that he can act as caretaker for his new little sister. With his school life ruined, the boy grows resentful of the poor girl. But that all changes when he learns just how much power his new enigmatic sister holds, as well as the danger she represents for the entire planet. In this bizarre and fantastic Sayuki story for a new generation, with writing and art by Daijiro Nonoe, this is The Last Sayuki. This is so outside of the wheelhouse on what I expect for a pitch for a Shonen Jump series.
Just from the synopsis, the pitch, just looking at it from the outside, it's kind of hard to understand what this would be. So, like, I totally understand if people were to look at this on a, my favorite word, surface level, and then just decide to pass.
That's one thing, is you'll see the design of these characters, and very unlike a lot of Shonen Jump series, this is about a third grade boy and a second grade girl, and they're drawn as such. They are young and small and not exactly who you would expect to be the protagonists of an action series, which this very much is.
I don't know about you, but everyone I went to high school with, including myself at 15, we were all built like Jotaro. That's just how it was.
Yeah, everyone was like looking like a 35-year-old man straight out of high school. Just defined jaws and strong features everywhere. The Last Sayuki, or Sayugo no Sayuki, ran in Weekly Shonen Jump from March 4th to August 19th of 2019. The series ran for 23 chapters and 3 volumes. The entire series can be found on the Shonen Jump app. The series was billed as a modernized reimagining of the highly influential 16th century Chinese novel Journey to the West. Everything I know about Journey to the West is from Dragon Ball. I will be upfront about that. And
That's fair.
I'm guessing it's required reading in Japan.
Because I was about to ask that, yeah.
That story is so ubiquitous in Japanese culture. It is a like constant presence in its media and game design and novels and manga.
Well, and for them, you know, Journey to the West is akin to, say, you know, the Iliad and Odyssey for more Western audiences.
This is the second Shonen Jump serialization for mangaka Daijiro Nonoe, who debuted in 2013 with the Edo period martial arts series Muto Black, which also got the early acts after just 12 chapters. Right out of the gate, what do you think of the premise behind a series that bills itself as both a kind of family adventure, but also a retelling of one of the most prolific Chinese novels in history?
Yeah, at first, especially at the very, very beginning, and how they try to hook you with the art and how they set it up, I was like, all right, let me hear more. I'm interested.
One thing before we get started with opening chapters is we're going to be cutting a lot out of this overall synopsis, and we're going to be trying to pick out, you know, what we enjoyed, because despite only being around 23 chapters, it's a dense series.
Yes, it is very dense.
And the one thing we're going to have to skip over is the fact that it starts off with a flash forward of basically one character's powers being introduced, and also like what the final arc of the series is, which is bold, to say the least.
Yeah.
To go ahead and start with not just like, oh, it's a flash forward of like something that will happen within three chapters. No, it's a flash forward of the very end, the very last thing. And with that, that takes us to our opening chapters, 1 through 3. Our story begins with our young protagonist, Ryunosuke Fujita, walking home after his first day of third grade. The stairway leading up to the Shinto shrine that he and his father call home makes for a grueling climb, but our plucky young protag is in too good of a mood to let that slow him down. After all, he is coming home with a permission slip to play baseball, his favorite sport. Ooh.
Oh, man. A little slow, yes. Get it.
His mood changes quickly, however, when he sees what's waiting for him at the top of the stairs. His father, Gohaku Fujita, standing alongside a wheelchair-bound girl with multiple prostheses by the name of Koharu Mori. Gohaku wastes no time in telling his son the situation. Koharu is an orphan, who Gohaku has adopted, and Ryo will be pulled from school in order to act as his older brother slash caretaker. Right out of the gate, what we're trying to empathize with is, your father's a dick,
yeah.
Here's your new sister, rip you.
He wants the readers to imagine if their parents were being a dick and they took away something that they really liked and they forced him to do something they didn't want to do. And I think that they wanted to have that level of like base reality connection so that later on when we start breaking reality and breaking from what we experience for day to day, the readers can see themselves in the shoes of Ryunosuke.
Ryunosuke, who we're going to call Ryu from here on out because, yeah, right? We're
going to say Ryunosuke. From Street?
From the streets of fight. Ryu, devastated by the news, tries to argue against the change, but the decision is made. Rather than being with friends and playing baseball, Ryu must now wait hand and foot on this blind and crippled girl. After 3 months of no school and no baseball, it becomes almost too much for the young boy. And I love how this character is written. This isn't somebody that's just like, man, this sucks. I hate this. I hate you. Like, I think a lot of writers will fall into the trap of writing this character to be a brat, to be redeemed. But yeah. Ryunosuke is very much a character that he does feel bad for this girl. He does feel bad that Koharu's an orphan and it's unfair that she has this terrible life. But it's like, why me? Why am I the one that has to be saddled with this? Why can't we go to a caretaker or a babysitter or something that's a better solution than saddle the third grade boy with caretaking duties?
They write them very realistic on how you would want to react in that kind of situation. The thing like that they impressed me the most is like the multiple emotions, anger at dad, a little bit anger at the girl, but also a little bit of guilt for feeling that anger, but also noticing how she is reacting to him. That is a deep level of like understanding of social dynamics and understanding of a character's point of view that I have not seen in the manga we've read to this point.
Like, it's a really good sign as a writer when you have child characters that aren't written as just brats or just shitty, because that happens a lot even in Shonen Jump, and it's always the underwhelming option when it comes to writing for kids.
Yeah, it really is.
One day, after caving in to his intense FOMO, Ryu leaves his sister alone at home for an afternoon, leaving the poor girl unsupervised when she suffers a heat stroke. Koharu thankfully recovers, but as punishment, a furious Gohaku locks the boy in an empty storeroom as a form of timeout on steroids. The small cracks and creaks of the storeroom cause the boy to experience a nervous breakdown. He begins to feel that something is in the darkness with him, something unnatural and horrific. Unable to shake the feeling that he's trapped with a monster, Ryu screams for help. Suddenly, Ryu hears a loud thud as the door to the storeroom cracks open, causing moonlight to flood in. Ryu rushes through the door, only to find Koharu, toppled out of her wheelchair with blood flowing down her head. The young girl, using nothing but her skull, knocked over the plank of wood, barring the doors in order to save her brother. So we have this scene of, again, childhood fear of darkness.
Yeah.
Written so freaking well, in the sense of you kind of have to pitch the idea that somebody can have a nervous breakdown being stuck in a dark setting. A lot of writers would flub that. A lot of writers add some kind of supernatural element, but this writer works really hard to make it so that it's just, this is what will happen. If you're in the third grade and you're stuck in a dark room, your imagination gets the better of you, and you think that something is going to kill you if you don't get out of here, and you have a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, he wrote it in a very concise way, but also a very real way to show this is the manifestation of anxiety. Something that we can relate to in our 30s, or something that you could relate to as a kid reading this manga. And then showing how the negative feedback loop can really send you into that kind of state. This isn't seen very often. This level of writing to describe this event feels very real and is not something I see too often. And I got to this scene and I was very impressed with how that was written. And then when Kohaku shows up and she was the one who opened the door, I was just like, oh, like, wow.
The way you have it written, it's just, he gets locked in a dark room and then the little sister comes in and takes him out of the dark room. And on paper, that doesn't sound like enough of a monumental event to reverse the resentment and cynicism this character has towards the little sister. But after seeing the kind of turmoil he's put in this storeroom, we totally get it when the next scene happens and they're just crying in a heap of like, I'm so sorry I was so mean to you, you know, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, something like that is absolutely traumatic as a third grader. And then someone that you've sort of like held quiet resentment for months came in and like did everything she could with, you know, no hands and legs to help her to get you out of that situation because, apparently she cares. Like Koharu doing that, like as a kid, that is monumental. That would absolutely be like the moment for me if I was put in Ryu's shoes.
When Ryo asks why she would go so far for him, Koharu can only cry and apologize, presumably for all the trouble she's put him through. This causes Ryu to break down as well and apologize for being so callous towards her. As he holds onto the girl's cold hands, Ryu vows to always protect her from harm and to, quote, be her light. Ryu could almost swear that the prosthetic arms squeezed back. Cut to much later in the evening, and we find, alongside awaking Ryu, that Koharu is no longer in her bed. The events prior caused the boy to hesitate in fear of the dark surroundings, but he eventually pushes on to find Koharu floating in the air and glowing faintly. As Ryu attempts to get a handle on what he's seeing, the still-sleeping Koharu inadvertently lets out a single phrase.
Behind you.
With that, the monster Ryu imagined in the storeroom, a grotesque mound of flesh and facial features, suddenly materializes behind him, immediately slinging its claws at our hero.
That's the kind of horror that I like. You know, it's not jump scares or anything. It's something as creepy as you go in and your little sister's floating. She never fucking speaks, and then she goes behind you. And then, oh, there's the thing I imagined. Fuck, there's my night terror monster. Hi.
Because that's writing pulling double duty. That is all those pages of Ryu talking about this monster. All of it plays into not only his ability to empathize with Koharu because she's blind and she experiences this constantly without calling for help or having a nervous breakdown, but it's also used to build up how frightening this creature is when it does actually materialize into the real world. Fortunately, before the monster can eviscerate the two children, a massive wooden pole flies across the room and obliterates the monster into an unmoving pile of mush. The source of the attack was a frantic Gohaku with what appears to be Goku's power pole from Dragon Ball Z, known in Japanese as a Noibo. After the dust settles, Gohaku tells his son the reason behind Koharu's appearance and, extensively, the premise of the series. In short, Koharu is not human, but rather a divine being, capable of showing people the quote-unquote truth. This means that her words have the power to materialize fears into the real world. Gohaku has taken it upon himself to shelter Koharu and teach her how to use this power for the good of humanity. And as a final kick in the pants, Gohaku plans on having this divine being find value in humanity by having her fall in love with Ryu. And that ends the first chapter. Is that twist of like, you don't love her. I'm just gonna love you.
Yeah, I just read, but my notes just say the answer is love.
There are small things about the series that kind of irk me, and I think the need to put stakes onto whether or not they build a relationship, it was unnecessary. You could just, you know, have the relationship be a byproduct of the adventures they go on.
Yeah, and I also don't think that's something that he should have, like, led with up front. Like, the pretext to what they want to build is messed up.
Because you have a lot of people now looking at this as, like, how much of this is just going to be Koharu and Ryu just forcibly getting along in order to protect humanity? And it's not even like that's what happens. They do have a very organic and beautiful relationship, but to kick things off by saying, oh, the stakes of the series depend on them liking each other, it makes the series sound like it's going to turn into like something that it just doesn't become. It wasn't the turn that this chapter should have ended on.
Yeah.
If we're thinking on a purely marketable level, I guess.
It left me pretty uncomfortable. The rest of this first chapter, great. Fantastic. What they ended it on, what they wanted to leave you with until next week, miss the mark.
Yeah, because there's so much about the series that I'm already hooked on to read in the next chapter. Like, I like this premise a lot. And then he said, oh, but also this thing. I don't like that thing. I'll keep reading.
Yeah.
But watch your ass with that thing.
Yeah. You, I don't know about that, Chief.
Gohaku apologizes for thrusting this plan on Ryu, but claims that there was no other way to protect the world. Ryu, for his part, responds by punching his father in the face and lecturing him on the irresponsibility of saddling a third-grade boy with a living cryptid printer. Ballsy. I like that.
Yeah, that is pretty ballsy. Just punch your dad right in his nose.
I think a lot of young protagonists, even ones that are like, you know, 13 and... Well, I guess when you're 13 and 15, you feel like, maybe I can handle things and whatnot. But this kid's in the third grade, and his dad's like, you have to be the protector of the world. Bullshit. I am 5, old man. You've done the fucking wrong thing here. You fucked up here. I love Ryunosuke as a character.
Yeah.
Just every single action he takes, it's what I would want to see out of more protagonists.
Yes.
Why are you making me do this bullshit? I shouldn't have to be the hero. I'm fucking 10. Yeah, it's a totally fair question. And Gohaku, he's just like, because I'm kind of stupid. And that's perfectly fine as a character to have just a completely irresponsible dad. And that plays into later parts of the series where Gohaku as a character, on his part, he reads a lot like Gendo from Evangelion. Just this fucking callous, like, I'm an asshole dad.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going into this with that assumption of the trope where he's just like, same. Hey, by the way, you're going to take care of this, you know, little girl now, and I'm going to bust out and do my job and blah, 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 blah. Gohaku is very much an indictment on the Gendo trope, which is already kind of an indictment on just shitty fathers.
Right.
But it kind of twists that into a very interesting way throughout the series. And right out of the gate, we're just establishing that Gohaku is a very powerful individual who has a sack of potatoes for brains and is very much a sad boy. And I love him. I love this sad, sad father.
Sad boy
of,
father.
Too.
I wrote in my, you'll like to hear this, I wrote in my notes, Ryu's dad is a Gendo asshole man? Question mark?
He's a Gendo asshole man? Koharu, awoken by the arguing in the other room, sheepishly apologizes for her part of the argument and vanishes. Despite having a wheelchair to move around in, we learn that she's capable of moving at incredible speeds while floating, as well as a whole hell of a bunch of other stuff. She's just OP. But she's got to hold it in, because if the world knows how OP she is, it would unleash more monsters like this, is the idea. So now it's time to track down the little sister, but first, an exposition dump!
Woohoo!
We learn from Gohaku that Koharu has been holding back on her powers out of concern for materializing monsters from the minds of others. We learn how monsters materialize, and it pretty much amounts to the same rule set of fairies and Santa Claus. So long as someone believes they exist, they exist. The ignorance to monsters humans naturally experience acts as a seal for monsters known as mo. Break a person's disbelief and you break their mo. Break open a person's mo and bada bing bada boom, cryptid. That's what we're working with.
Wait a minute. Okay? Wait a minute. Is that what happened to Slender Man? Did he? Was he created by people
my dude,
on a forum and then materialized in this kind of way and resulted into that those girls stabbing that other girl? Is that what happened?
My boy, in real life? My child. I'm telling you right now that this is in fact Slender Man the manga.
Whoa.
That's exactly what this is, and I love it. I love how
I didn't put that two and two together till just now. Of a
you're
Slender
a
Man.
Fool.
With the Slender Man.
Because you're missing half the reason why this thing is genius. Because it's taking on pretty common facets of cryptid culture. This idea of if you say its name or if you believe in it and whatnot, that's when shit gets scary. That's literally a mechanic in this world.
Oh, no. Right? The mechanic I totally understood. And with cryptid, like, being someone who loves, like, cryptid stuff, UFO stuff and all that, you know, this is something I'm familiar with. I just didn't think to compare it to Slender Man. And the mythology for that.
They don't bring up Slender Man. They bring up more. This is more Japanese cryptids, if anything. But we can assume that in this universe, a Slender Man can materialize if you fear Slender Man enough.
That's
and the same goes
terrifying.
For Momo, and the same goes for everything. Yeah, we have that mythology because we tell stories about these cryptids that exist when you believe in them. And it's a horrifying prospect. Like, it is a prominent part of our culture. This is good writing.
Yeah.
I am very much enjoying this.
Yes, sir.
Now, granted, this is still exposition dump, but it's like, you could do exposition dump if it's interestingly written. And it's a weird aspect about the series that a lot of the series is explaining the magic system and the power system. But it's done so in such an interesting, intricate way that I personally, as a reader, can't look away. And I'm enthralled. I really am. Like, oh, I love this world. I love where a lot of the references are pulling from and how they're using that in a battle shonen setting. Cool, cool, cool.
Yes.
After this explanation of the world's magic system, Ryu is quick in determining that Koharu wanted to keep a distance from him so that he's no longer endangered by her powers and that she's probably hiding in the last place Ryu would want to visit, the dark storeroom. With Ryu's mo now open, entering the dark storeroom again will result in the monster materializing immediately. But this doesn't stop Ryu from showing his little sister that he's not afraid of her. Armed with his father's magical Nyobo, Ryu is able to overcome his fear and destroy the monster with a massive Barry Bonds swing for the fences. Koharu, relieved to know that her brother is prepared to face the dangers ahead, says thank you. The siblings have finally become a family. The next day, Ryu is given his own Nyobo staff, as well as a history lesson courtesy of his father. It turns out that the tales of Genju Zanzo and the journey to the west are real, if slightly altered. In reality, Genju Zanzo traveled across a monster-ridden China in order to grant the power of the Nyobo to those who wish to defend themselves against monsters, as well as the Demon King Kei and his followers of Chaos, who wish to see the world ruled by monsters. Remember that name, Demon King K. Mm-hmm. That is something that you will be rewarded for keeping an eye on in this series. We learn that this Demon King had the same abilities of Koharu, and the followers of Chaos, alive to this very day, wish to abduct Koharu and force her to use her power for evil in order to start a new era of monsters. We're then introduced to these followers of Chaos in a quick side story. A gentle-looking boy flanked by two masked individuals, as they observe a horrific monster slaughtering an unknown classroom. The gentle boy known as Sai speaks of how tiring it is to open people's mo without the use of divine power and makes his intentions clear. He, along with his fellow cultists, wants Koharu Mori. They introduce these cultists, the followers of Chaos, and it's fucked. Because the page turn for this is, again, this small, like, grade school kid talking to this class, saying, farewell. You turn the page, and it's a two-page spread of a pretty intense slaughter scene.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting to see this, like, that kind of level. But it gave me the same kind of feeling as one of the first big reveals at the beginning of Promised Neverland. It's terrifying.
That takes us to the first arc of the series, chapters 4 through 8, the Nurari Hiren arc. In order to assure that Koharu's location is kept hidden from the followers of Chaos, Kohaku asks Ryu if he has told anyone at all about Koharu when he left her alone. He admits that he told his best friend Shige about Koharu. With that, Kohaku makes a plan to invite Shige over in order to, quote, deal with him. And
all right,
it's kind of humorous because Ryu hears this. He goes, deal with him how? He's like, no. I'm not Gendo. I'm not Gendo. Don't call me Gendo.
Don't call me Gendo. I'm not Gendo.
We learn in a short flashback that Shige helped Ryu get over the death of his mother and that they've been lifelong friends since. Koharu is concerned that she's incapable of making friends due to her condition, but Ryu assures her otherwise. After a few days, Shige finally arrives at the shrine, only to find that the trembling boy's Mo is practically bursting with the dark essence of a monster egg. The terrified child tells of a mysterious kid who came to his baseball camp and told stories of a Japanese monster of folklore known as the Norihiron. After that, weird things started happening at the camp. Things that Shige refuses to elaborate on out of fear that something might appear if he were to recount them. I love the scene because they show this kid nervously smiling, but he's just like trembling, like he is terrified. And we get to see what his Mo looks like, and what it basically is just it's an invisible box containing a little bit of dark essence to show like how much fear you're going through. We can tell immediately that, oh shit, this kid is like traumatized.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool to see a pain meter chart of the mother who has empty Mo and she's fine and I'll look at my silly kid, and the kid whose Mo is like bursting and cracking and crumbling with this dark essence just bursting out of it. And he's just looks like he's about to shit himself on the spot.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
After informing Shige that monsters do not exist, Gohaku talks to Ryu and Koharu separately and informs them of the plan to save Shige from the fear that he is about to materialize. Gohaku wants to use Koharu's power to materialize the beast at an opportune time so that he and Ryu can quickly destroy it. With Gohaku's understanding of the folklore behind the Norihiron, the gang already have knowledge on the creature's strengths and weaknesses. This means that even with the terrifying squid samurai amalgam's ability to become incorporeal, Gohaku and Ryu are able to make quick work of the monster.
I think this is super cool. A little facet of this world and the mechanics behind the monsters I thought was really neat. Like, think about like the SCP Foundation kind of stuff. If those two were to materialize, we would know exactly what it does and exactly how to deal with it.
It's a really good battle mechanic. It means that even if you know what their broad fear might be, you don't really have a great idea of what's going to come out of it unless you know the origin of that fear. And the battle itself is cool in terms of how they deal with an incorporeal character. They're just like, well, the same goes for him. If he wants to attack us with his samurai blade, he's going to have to become corporeal in order to do it. And we fucking throw his shit out the window the second he does that. You know, it's an easy battle, but it's very cool how they go through the thought process of why it's such an easy battle. Because it wasn't just because our heroes are badass, it's because our heroes utilize the knowledge that they have at their disposal in order to take care of this monster in the most efficient way possible.
Right.
All that's left now is to replace Shige's memories with fake ones using the most convoluted neuralizer mechanic in manga. And Shige can return home safely with no knowledge of monsters or of Koharu. Ryu is relieved for his friend, but also upset that he'll have no knowledge of Koharu, who did so much to save him. He asks his father if Koharu would be safe to make friends in the outside world if the followers of Chaos weren't around. Serendipitously enough, Ryo doesn't have to go far to find them. As the gentle boy of the Chaos cult, Sai makes himself known to the others at the shrine. Sai introduces himself as the second-in-command of the followers of Chaos, the person behind Shige's condition and, shockingly enough, the true big brother to Koharu. Sai demands to be given Koharu, and a fight breaks out between the cultist and Gohaku. Ryu and Koharu make a break for it, but stop when they realize that Sai will probably kill their father. Koharu presents Ryu with a choice. Give her up to Sai and return to a normal life with his father, or rescue her and put the lives of his friends and family in constant danger. Ryu picks option 3, protecting Koharu and his family by being a complete badass. This causes Ryu and Koharu's soul to connect and grants Ryu the strength to fend off Sai with some badass Niobo chicanery. Ryu pretty much says, alright, well, here's the deal. Number one, I'm going to extend it in multiple ways, doing fucking trigonometry in my head to attack you from like 1,000 feet away. I'm going to take control of your Niobo You're going to put your Noyobo in the ground to try to hit me and whatnot. I want to use mine as a shield and then have the connection between our two Noyobo allow me to, you know, hit you in the face with your own Noyobo. There's got to be a better term for these than Noyobo, though. That's really
hard. It's a very awkward word in English, like straight up.
But it's so cool. It's a really cool fight. Having been disarmed and restrained by Ryu, Sai attempts to coax Ryu to join him as allies, but gets interrupted when his head explodes via another Niyoibo pole. Yeah, that's even worse. Niyoibo pole?
Niyoibo pole. Niyoibo. Fuck.
Yeah, give it a shot. Give it a shot. Five times.
That's a tongue twister right there.
Niyoibo pole.
I couldn't do it once.
Niyoibo pole. The mystery attacker, accompanied by a shocked young girl, is shown to be a short man in a business suit known as Nero Furuka. Every other chapter, they're introducing new characters, and they're all beautifully written, but they are given a lot of time to be intricately written.
Yeah. And at the time, we're like, who the fuck are you? Like, why did you show up? And I know they go into it, but, like, undercutting the scene and how, like, triumphant it is, and all of a sudden it's like, all right, here's some new characters, and let's go into them for a second. Totally switched the gears. It was a little uncomfortable.
Ryu just had his first real victory against a substantial foe, and it's already taken away because we have to move on to the next plot point.
Yeah, I wondered if, like, the writer, you know, was really excited about the story, they're really excited about these characters, and that they just wanted you to like them as well and get really ingrained. So trying really, really hard, you know, here's the backstory, you know, here's what we like about them. And I think that's something that could have been spread out a bit more. I think that rush actually was to their detriment.
Nero tries to calm Ryu down by telling him that he works with his father and that the Sai they just fought wasn't the real deal, but rather a monster copy. Not that that actually explains anything at this point, but whatever. The stern-looking Nero wastes no time in making the purpose of his visit known. He's there to investigate why Gohaku is in possession of Koharu. There's another twist. Just keep coming.
Yeah.
Because apparently, okay, Koharu got kidnapped by Gohaku, and that's its own subplot to go along with, that has to be, it's like the 7th, 8th subplot of this series.
Yeah.
Again, an interesting subplot.
Yeah, it is.
But it's really crowded now. I'm really stuffed in this box of good writing. Before we can get an explanation behind what he means by that, Ryu's brain short circuits from the stress of using Koharu's power, causing him to pass out, leading us into a dream sequence. It's not like a flashback arc, but it's close. It's like flashback chapter.
Yeah.
That takes us to the Shinjino Island arc, chapters 9 through 17. In this dream sequence, Ryu has a conversation with the memories of Koharu's previous life as the Demon King of China, Kei. Kei here looks like an older Koharu, but with a mask and with, like, blotted out eyes that for some reason express a lot of emotion when they're drawn, so good on the artist. Their talk is charmingly written, but pretty much amounts to another exposition dump. We learn that Mo, and how open it is, essentially acts as a power level for this universe. The more willing you are to believe in the impossible, the more capable you are at performing the impossible. Kei also gives Ryu a warning. No matter their efforts, Koharu will be used to awaken the Mo of every person on the planet in order to create an earth-destroying monster. Rather than focusing on preventing that, he should prepare to fight this final monster to the best of his ability when the time comes. And this threat hits, not even a threat, this prophecy hits a lot more because we had the flash forward at the beginning. It was like, yes, it does happen.
Yeah. Yeah, we saw it.
And it acknowledges, like, because we're, what, 9 chapters in, and we've given no reference to what the hell that first opening was. And, like, here's how super intricately thought out the series was. It's all for the payoff of a reveal in chapter 9? Eventually, Ryu wakes from the dream and finds himself in a strange new house. As he looks to see who is in the house with him, he discovers Nero's associate from earlier, the 11-year-old Estelle Yotaka, cosplaying and posing as a magical girl on TV. Estelle, after dealing with the embarrassment of being caught cosplaying, gives Ryu a rundown on what's happened since Ryu passed out. His family has been taken to a city under the jurisdiction of the Monster Defense Alliance, otherwise known as the Tokaishu. We learn a lot about the Tokaishu, And all of it is really interesting. But to summarize, it's a globalized Monster Hunters Guild full of people who cosplay to psych themselves up.
That is so cool. Like, you...
Ooh, I love the fucking Tokaishu!
Yeah, like, you take... Like, you cosplay as a character to, like, sort of gain their confidence to make you, like, get hyped up to take on these crazy-ass tasks and fight this crazy-ass shit you have to. Like, that is so cool. Give me Captain Falcon's outfit, and I will Falcon punch everyone.
It took a while to get here, but we pretty much got to what this battle series is. Because every battle series is the same, okay? It's all, here are the bad guys, they're running amok, now check out the good guys, let's have a fight. They all are just wrestling in that regard, okay? The only differentiation is the setting. What are the actual, you know, context for these heroes and villains? In My Hero Academia, it's actual heroes and villains. Like, that's just how they're referred to. In Naruto, it's ninjas. And in One Piece, it's the government versus pirates and da-da-da-da-da. There's something so fucking compelling about having your good guy, bad guy dynamic be a bunch of LARPers going up against cryptids that are formed from the materialization of our fears. So it's a world where everyone's like dressed up like a fucking goofy character and it has a mechanical benefit. And this fucking writer figured out a really interesting way to have that premise work in a way that doesn't just feel like fan service or some kind of just plastered on attempt of like, oh, isn't cosplaying cool just in general? Like, God, there's so much that rules about this series.
It is so neat. And I love also how there's a lot of like, underpinning of like maybe dog whistling to themes from the occult. And for this show especially, there's a lot of like chaos magic kind of stuff where it's just,
yes,
I am taking something and I'm using it for a purpose, therefore it is real and it's happening. You know, for the manifestation of the monsters to basically taking, you know, making these characters come to life and to serve a purpose mechanically is super cool. And the way they explained it, I was 100% on board.
We eventually learn that while Gohaku is under investigation for kidnapping Koharu from the Tokaishu, Nero will be in charge of overseeing the siblings. This includes taking Ryu and Noharu on a job to eliminate a monster infestation for the local town of Shijino Island. The rest of this arc consists of multiple fights with demented dog-like creatures known as Karori on this island, an exposition-filled fight between Nero and a follower of Chaos with the ability to remove and reattach his limbs with no ill effects, and an emotional arc for Estelle as she learns how to cope with survivor's guilt in order to acquire the strength to fight alongside Ryu and Koharu. There is a lot I just glanced over. So, Alex, off the top of your head, what was it about this arc that was like, ooh, that's really cool? Because I got a couple.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I especially like to see how the monsters in this world interact and how they can evolve in a very short time span. But I think for me especially, the emotional arc with Estelle was really nice. Because we get info dumps on her, but we get a really like interesting way of, I am traumatized through certain events, and it is the sole focus of my insecurities. And I have to find a way to deal with these insecurities so I can feel like I can get things accomplished, my goals met. And the way it's brought about and the way that it comes to fruition is very, very neat. You know, there's only a couple things in this whole arc that irk me, but overall it's things like that, the development of situations like that made me really happy.
We have a fight with these Kurari, which are dogs brought about by disease, which is, that's the big theme of this, is the fear of disease manifesting into a monster that, if defeated, cures the disease.
Yeah.
And that plays into Estelle's character arc because Estelle suffered from a disease and her mother, despite it being against the law to materialize monsters and defeat them in order to cure diseases, she had to rely on that in order to save her daughter. And this resulted in her being killed by the monster, but curing the disease that plagued Estelle as a child. one aspect of Ark plays into another that will then play into the insecurities that Nero has going up against this cultist member who's calling him out on, like, dude, you want to act like a hard ass, but you have to cut off all emotion in order to be a true divine being capable of the shit I'm capable of, where I chop my head off and I'm just okay. And that comes from Nero's dedication to protecting Estelle, regardless of how he likes to pretend that he's a hard ass and he's cut off his emotions. He really hasn't. He's just he's as much of a baby as anyone else. Everything plays upon itself. And it's just, there's so much of it, though, that I don't know how you present this in a way that doesn't either stretch the series out into a much longer arc or cut out stuff that, God, I don't know what you cut out. To have all of these elements intricately woven together is such beautiful writing that is almost endangering itself. It's almost like, because it's like really good writing that's leading to bad writing habits. But yeah, I loved Estelle's emotional arc. I loved that Ryu pretty much got to take point on this mission to fight off these dogs. And we get to see him like, he's a badass.
Yeah.
Ryunosuke is a fucking cool
dude. He really goes for it.
It feels almost way too much power escalation and way too much power up and up and up. But it's like physical power doesn't matter here. It's all mental power.
Right. Especially on the factor of pulling from like mental energy to really beef up and level up in your power. I love in this series where this happens each and every time. We look at Estelle and she's looking at the stuff with her mom and how it was dealt with and then how her time with Nero was going on to affect her emotions and then her basically gaining strength by getting through those traumatic events with the death of her mom.
There's really something neat about having all of these characters in this battle shonen have their strength derived from their ability to overcome trauma.
Yes.
And then give each of these characters very interesting trauma to overcome. The only complaint is that they have too many characters doing these really interesting conflicts of the trauma at the same time. And it feels like everything has to be rushed, or it feels like everything is just jumbled together in a way that, honestly, the presentation of this is not able to really catch up with. So it's weird. I have, like, nothing but good things to say about The Last Saiyuki other than the fact that there's too many good things.
Yeah. It's just, I really think if there was the ability for this to be stretched over, I don't know, 100 chapters or something, like, there is a way to write this to where we get all the information we need and we get all the feelings we need and we get all the building of characters and world that we need without trying to cram it all together in a very dense series. Unfortunately, I just don't know if that would have gone over. And I think that was the author's fear. The author was afraid if I were to slow burn this to really sink in what I want to, they're going to cancel this real quick because they're not going to see what I see as, you know, that I have the whole story and everything figured out. So I'm going to try to front load a lot of this. And unfortunately, it's a gamble. And I understand why you would take that gamble. I 100% understand. But unfortunately, it seems like that gamble didn't quite work out. And it's a shame. It really is.
This takes us to the last arc of the series, the Black Tory Gate arc, chapters 18 through 23. Things do not slow down for Ryu, Koharu, Estelle, or Nero after the events on Shijino Island. After all, the Oban Festival will be happening soon.
Woohoo! Party time.
We learn that festivals, especially ones focused on deceased loved ones, can often result in the manifestation of, quote, Black Tory Gates, inanimate monsters that trap people in pocket dimensions that resemble the afterlife. For those who don't know, they don't really explain this because it's a Japanese culture thing, but an Oban festival is essentially the Japanese equivalent of Dia de los Muertos. Mm-hmm. The gang receives orders to seal these gates off as they appear at various shrines. It's a monotonous job, to say the least, but we get to learn a lot about how monsters can sometimes materialize from the collective fears of many people, which is a very relevant aspect in the ending chapters of this arc.
Yes, and I love this. This section in particular gives me strong Persona 5 vibes, and, you know, with the shadows manifesting from people's desires, fears, etc. I love this kind of concept.
During their mission, Ryu and Estelle share their experiences of grieving over a mother, while Koharu thinks back on what her mother must have been like and offhandedly mentions that she wants to meet her. This causes a massive black torii gate to appear, and on the other side of that gate, as if taunting our hero, is the silhouette of Ryo's mother. Nairo seals the gate before anyone can pass through, and the gang do their best to leave it be. But later that evening, Koharu gives in to temptation and passes through the seal effortlessly to see what answers the gate holds. Nero tries to stop his pupils from following her, but with the help of some trickery and the sudden appearance of Kohaku, Ryu and Estelle are able to break the seal and chase after Koharu. There's a small little scuffle between Ryunosuke and Nero that I fucking love. Yeah. Because, again, the fights depend on your mental state. So despite the fact that Nero is far stronger than Ryunosuke is without the help of Koharu, Ryu is clever enough to be like, okay, no, I get it. But you see, you're concentrating on putting up the seal, right, and everything? Here's the deal. A fucking kiss to Estelle. Like a fucking Chad. And Estelle's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And it's enough. Like, Nero's like, the fuck is he talking about? And he just runs through the fucking gate like a badass. Like, what a fucking Chad this dude is.
It was clever. I'll give him that.
With four chapters remaining, we see what waits for Ryu and Estelle behind the gate. A train car holding the being from the dream sequence from before, Kay. Kay proceeds to explain the future events of the series in a 3-chapter-long exposition dump for the ages.
Yeah, seriously.
So here's what we learn. We learn that when a monster is materialized from the collective fear of a natural disaster or apocalyptic event, that defeating the monster will result in those disasters being averted. This collective fear leads to creatures as small as the humble Kappa to the gargantuan Yamada no Orochi, the 8-headed dragon. And they show a spread of this dragon, and let's talk about the art real quick of this series. How fucking good is this art?
I love it.
We're 3 to 4 chapters close to the end, and we're getting these full art spreads. Mm-hmm. We're getting this world building. It does not feel like this series is about to get canceled.
Yeah, not at all.
We're told that whenever humanity faces a world-ending calamity, it becomes the job of the Kay to materialize those fears into an apocalyptic monster that the counterpart to Kay, the being of light known as Sai, defeats. This cycle has happened twice before, as told in the Indian tale of the Ramayana and the Chinese tale of the Sayuki. Those are real-life stories. And Now, the third tale is about to be told. As for why Gohaku kidnapped Koharu in the first place, he explains to Nero that it stems from just pure selfishness. Despite the fact that the Sai of this tale was already chosen, Gohaku wanted desperately to have Ryu become the Sai so that he might survive the hellish era to come. Upon learning this truth, Ryu finally catches up to Koharu, who has also learned the truth of her origin. But nothing about their relationship has changed despite everything. Ryu tells his sister that he'll always be there. Upon returning from the gate, Ryu and Koharu see Gohaku bowing his head in remorse over not telling them the hell that they're about to face. But Ryu rejects the gesture. This world isn't hell, Ryu states. Ryu plans on making more friends and showing Koharu the world and sharing his life with his father, regardless of what happens in the future. We get a flash forward of the events to come in the final chapter. The apocalyptic monster looms over Tokyo. The world watches in shock at the horror to come, but standing together at the street are our heroes. An older Ryunosuke stands in front of his friends and family with a Niobo staff shaped like a bat in his hand. I already know what the future holds, says the young Ryu, as we see his future self take a massive swing, with the ending pages showing a baseball being launched through the air, and so ends the last Sayuki. For me, this is a series that I think deserved to be in something other than Shonen Jump. And not just, you know, it could have been in a better manga publication. It could have been a novel. It could have been an internet series of some kind. Like, there is something to this story that would have worked in a medium that doesn't require constant action and constant focus on fun times and happy times and whatnot. There's a lot about this premise, about the character writing, that it isn't just good, it's remarkable. It's revolutionary. Gohaku is one of the best father characters in Shonen Jump because he displays fatherhood in a time where honestly, if you're giving birth to the world right now, you can't help but feel terrible. 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 40 years from now, we might be fucked. We might be just absolutely fucked. And if you're bringing children into this world, I think it's fair to have concern about, like, what does that do for our child? And for some reason, that understanding of fatherhood in the modern age is not really depicted in anything, much less Shonen Jump manga. So to have this fatherhood figure become the face of the remorseful generation that will come to pass, that will leave behind the world worse off than it was before, who feels guilty about it, but continues to make the same mistakes over and over again, and continues to make selfish decisions, I really want to see more characters like that. And it's a shame that the one series that was really providing it to my knowledge couldn't pull through.
Mm-hmm.
I think Ryunosuke is a fantastic protagonist, but I understand that he's small. He's not designed like a Shonen Jump protagonist. I understand that the writing is very exposition heavy, but man, when you really sit down and figure out what this artist wants to say, I can't help but want more. If you enjoy world building, if you enjoy climate change allegory told in the context of a very competent battle manga, this is it. This is a fantastic series. The only problem is it's only 23 chapters, 3 volumes, and it ends on such a bummer that, you know, you can't help but feel like dejected after reading it. So as for how I'm rating the series, this is a 9. This is a exceptional series that I would ask anyone to at least give a read if you're looking to experiment with how you can have your power mechanics integrate into your character writing, how you can relay real world events into a battle system that is enthralling and interesting, how you can have heroes that are very much relatable. If you're looking for that, this is a must read.
I can absolutely agree with everything you're saying in terms of the praises and the things that need to be worked on for this series. For people who are writers and you want to know how to build characters, how to tell stories and talk about certain things that we deal with emotionally or as a society, that is not very often talked about in this sort of media, this is a good read for that. There is a lot of positive lessons to be learned in the overall structure and development of this manga. This manga does so much right, and the things that fall short are nothing in comparison to some of the other shows that we've read and why they failed. There's not one quality for The Last Saiyuki that is like a huge deal breaker. There's not a big glaring red flag of, ooh, this is why it should be canceled, or this is why it was canceled. There's a lot of very small things, but overall, this is one of those series that it came so close. When I really got into the first, you know, 4+ chapters, I thought to myself, where does it go wrong? Because I'm really liking this. And when I finished it, I thought, I loved this. There's a lot going for it, and I would firmly give it a 9 as well. It absolutely deserves it. Honestly wish this was... I'm saving my 10 for a show that I am absolutely wrecked that it didn't continue. And this really hit me. It absolutely did. But I can see some of the flaws. I'm waiting for the 10 to give that 10 for me. That is just so great. I have no clue why it was canceled. And this one, so close to that. Firm 9 on this.
A 10 for me means that I'm writing the Shonen Jump and being like, explain yourself.
Yeah. Tell me why you canceled it. This is great.
I don't care if the ratings were bad or if it didn't sell well. Just fucking give me this one for once. I can think of a lot of manga in Shonen Jump right now that are worse than The Last Saiyuki that are still getting run.
Yeah.
I want more stories like this. I would love to see more intricate world building and greater themes that actually speak to the struggles of the hell that is 2020 and having your battle series reflect the hell of 2020. Hey, The Last Saiyuki hits it out of the ballpark.
Sure does.
Eh?
I see what you
baseball
doing
pun?
That's a good one.
Thank you so much for listening in to another episode of the Shonen Fiasco Show. Check us out on iTunes. Check us out on Spotify. Check us out on Twitter @ Shonen Fiasco. We post the memes. We post the dreams. We post whatever kind of update we got going on.
The music for this episode's pitch comes from The Game Brass. It is a video game music brass quintet that I'm a member of. I play tuba in it. I do want to shout out one other thing that our listeners might enjoy.
Please shout it out, yeah. Please.
Is to Caleb Hiles. Us here at The Game Brass, we got to record for an awesome charity performance of You Say Run from My Hero Academia. And it features like 50 musicians and actually also features some of the English cast members from the show. So
that's cool as hell. Wow.
Yeah, it was very hype and it is a great video. And you can buy the track as well from like Bandcamp, stuff like that. And of course, all the proceeds go to charity.
Next episode, we will be talking about another series that a lot of people did not like to see get canceled, Time Paradoxed Ghost Rider.
This is one of the ones that I've seen on Twitter without looking it up about how frustrated people are that it's being canceled.
We're just hitting you with the good stuff back to back. Thanks again for tuning in to the Shonen Fiasco Show. I am Adam Tetramore.
And I am Alex Hill.
Be sure to read everything.
Stuffing yourself with meatballs rolling down the hill.
Mr. Tetramore, I know you did not just compare this manga to the feeling of being a fat man rolling down a hill.